Welcome to Circle Sanctuary Network Podcast, brought to you by Circle Sanctuary, one of the oldest nature spirituality churches in the United States, connecting people of nature-centered paths around the world. Join us through the week for a variety of shows discussing various topics, celebrating the divine in all of its forms, through nature worship, rituals, education, and building bridges of community.
Good evening, good morning, good night, good second breakfast, whenever you are, wherever you are. My name is Laura Gonzalez, and I welcome you to Lunatic Mondays on CSMP, the Circle Sanctuary Network podcast. Tonight, I have a guest with whom I'm itching to start asking the hard questions. Nathan King from Michigan is a witch, occultist, psychic, and high priest of Minas of the Minoan Brotherhood tradition. He spent a good deal of his magical life being trained in historic Salem, Massachusetts. He has been featured on, I don't know how to read this, SYFY, I guess.
Sci-fi.
And the Travel Channel during his time in Witch City, and has presented at several events within his field. So, Nathan, welcome to Lunatic Mondays. How are you?
Hello, thank you so much for having me. I'm feeling enchanted, and I'm feeling just very buzzed with magic. It's been a very eventful couple of weeks, and there's been some very good witchy movies that have been coming out with the October season upon us. So I'm very in the spirit of things.
It is indeed. And don't forget, everybody, that today is October. What is it today? Today is October 28th. It's not, but it is. But it's not, but it is, because the magic is such. You all know I've been pre-recording Lunatic Mondays. I used to do them live, Nathan.
Goodness.
All the time. And my schedule changed in such a way, thank you God, is that I just have to pre-record now. So we're sometime in the past, but actually we're in the future with you. And yes, all the movies. Have you seen Beetlejuice?
Oh, it's so good. And I had a group of friends who just saw it, and I was like, you all need to strap in, because it was way better than Hocus Pocus 2, I'll say that.
Ooh, I like Hocus Pocus 2 a lot, too.
I liked Hocus Pocus 2, but I don't know, it had the flavor of the original for me that I really liked with Michael Keaton.
It was different.
It was fun.
But anyway, let's do the thing. And let's talk. Of course, we're going to talk about his book, Awakening the Witch Blood by Nathan King, Embodying the Art of Magical, and is published by Cross Crow Books. I know those kids. What can I say about Wick and Blake? I don't know. Before we go into the book, Nathan, how did you know you were a witch, became a witch, transitioned into witchcraft? What's your origin story?
Yeah, for me, I think it really started, obviously, I think for a lot of people, it starts in childhood, but the figure of the witch had always followed me. I was always in theater. The witch was always my favorite character in storytelling and plays. The Wizard of Oz was always something that was intimately a part of my life, being a collector and just an Oz fanatic. So there was always something about witches. But it wasn't until I encountered the tarot when I was in middle school. And it was actually sort of this nice bridge between very mystical stuff that was happening and figuring out that, like, oh, I can actually like take power over these things. And then somebody said something along the lines of, oh my gosh, you're a total witch. And I was like, yes, it made total sense. It was sort of all the puzzle pieces of things of my weirdness came together. And then I seriously started studying and reading as much as I could after that. At that time, YouTube, especially like the witchy YouTube community, was just starting to pop off in its popularity. So I really got invested specifically in like the historical documentaries and footage from a lot of the people in the British traditional witchcraft movement. And it was through that lens that I actually really, really pursued British traditional witchcraft, folkloric witchcraft. And that's the route that took me to Salem, and the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. And are there any particular the years that you got the opportunity to like studied under, I don't want to name names, so I'll let you do that.
Absolutely. So I had the absolute joy, privilege, pleasure, honor of studying with Lori Cabot. Lori Cabot is the official witch of Salem, and she is the person who single-handedly brought what I would equate as real witchcraft to modern-day Salem, Massachusetts. And really, she gives you the foundations, and she gives you, for me, what was the groundbreaking work of accessing psychic ability, and that was something very much life-changing. And it was something that, I was able to pursue through her books, through her online classes. Like, there were a lot of opportunities that naturally just kind of made a path for me to Salem. But then after my time with Lori, I came across the Minoan Brotherhood and found a completely different tradition, and something that was very in line with my feelings and beliefs as a queer person. And that was a very exciting thing. And that all circled back to today, where currently I'm part of a Gardnerian coven. And I also run Minoan Grove. So it's this very nice complementary thing that's occurred.
I'm unfamiliar with the Minoan Brotherhood or the Minoan tradition. Can you explain a little bit?
Yeah, so the
You
Minoan
have
Brother.
elevator speech.
Yeah, so the Minoan Brotherhood is an offshoot of what is something that we would call neo-Gardnerian witchcraft. It's based off of the Gardnerian tradition, but this is coming out of a time in the 70s where this was a v there were very traditional ways of doing things, and those things have changed since then. But at that time, there was a man named Eddie Buzinski, and Eddie really felt inclined to create a space of his own for people that were gay, that were lesbian, that were queer. And so he created the Minoan tradition, or the Cult of the Double Axe, really out of his love for his people that were in New York that wanted to just have a circle. And there's a lot of politics with that. One of the books that's going to be getting into all of that that's coming up is actually a biography about Raymond Buckland, because Buckland is also involved with this. That biography is coming out by Jason Mankey very soon. So I'm pretty excited about that. But you can also read about it in Bull of Heaven by Michael Lloyd, which is probably the single-handed best sort of history of how the Minoan Brotherhood and the New York Wiccatrad came to be. Very much Gardnerian and Gardnerian based, but because they had their separation, they have their own distinctions, they have their own flavors, and they stand on their own legs.
Yeah. And because my understanding is that Gardnerian is very gender specific, some of the practices.
Absolutely. Rooted
And
in this idea of a binary. And at that time, and certainly some people today, but not all Gardnerian covens, only subscribed that with people who were male, people who were female. And obviously, Eddie saw that may not be the case, that gender wasn't really what these things were talking about, pointing to. And so a lot of people have followed suit after Eddie. He was really sort of a pioneer in these free thinking ideas. But there's nothing more traditional, I think, than going with the spirit of that. And so specifically because I think this man was particularly in love with the goddess, in a way that most people would not understand, I think, in today's day and age.
And it's still ludicrous to me that it's 2024 and we still think that people who don't own a uterus shouldn't be worshiping the goddess. Like, this is ridiculous. And you find groups that are male or female or mixed or whatever, but they still say, oh no, to do the goddess, you have to have a vulva. You cannot have
Right.
the other kind of pipe because then, and people just haven't understood that the goddess is universal and encompasses everything. Speaking of books recommendations, since you mentioned a few, I have to say, Bending the Binary, Bending the Binary
By
is
Deborah Lipp.
Bending the Binary is a must, especially if you would like to join us in 2024. Come on, we don't bite unless you ask us. But come to 2024 and read Bending the Binary by Deborah Lipp. It's a fantastic book. I had the pleasure to interview of interviewing her when the book just came out, and man, I'm a slow reader. We are, all my listeners, they know I'm a slow reader. It has nothing to do with the accent and everything to do with I learn from listening. That's why I do podcasts. Because whatever you tell me is going to resonate more than whatever I've read on your book. And to the point, Laura. And when her book came out, I couldn't put it down. It's like more. A very excellent book. But enough about other books. Let's go into this book. Awakening the Witch Blood, and the first reaction, and probably many people's first reaction, is like, here we go with the blood and the lineage and the heritage, and are witches made? Are they trained? Are they born? And my answer to that has always been yes, right? And then you grab the book, and of course, when I got the book, right, thank you to the Cross Crow Book people, Cross Crow Books, I got the book, and I'm like, here we go. And then I open the book, and I'm like, wait a minute, this is not what I think it is.
Surprise.
Surprise! Tell us where this book idea come from.
Absolutely. And thank you, because this is a really great thing. And I didn't realize all the controversy until after I wrote the book, which is super interesting. But I was very interested in these ideas of why do people want to make the separation out of this idea of hierarchy or power grab or whatever, based off of the idea of like blood. It was also sort of my annoyance in looking through witchcraft history at what I call the grandmother story. Even if it's not a grandmother, there's some sort of mystical woman that teaches you something, or there's something mystical, right? And it happens, but yet the story is similar. And there were keys to it, and I wanted to dive into what were these stories actually pointing to. And then I went down the rabbit hole, and I was like, oh my gosh, everybody has the sleeping ember. Everybody has the sleeping ember. And it's not a matter of you have it or you don't. It's a matter of can you awaken this thing? And some people will fall into it for a myriad of different reasons, but it's a skill, right? The skill can be learned, it can be practiced. Some people are more inclined to it than others. But more importantly, the witchcraft that I practice, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the kind of witchcraft that other people practice, but my witchcraft is a priesthood. So as a priesthood, there's a vocational calling to it that's always sort of been there. I've always felt in service to something beyond myself, if that makes sense. And I think a lot of witches and witches who read this book find that seed, and that's a very important seed to pay attention to. But then, with this idea of blood, it was this idea of the body, which is everything that we are and everything that we do in rituals. We exercise this physical instrument as the altar of the old ones. So I thought that was interesting. And then I realized every symbol, every word, everything is embodied, and everything is because we've got this coursing through our veins that we call magic. Oh my gosh, this is the witch blood. And so, in a way, writing the book was a form of protest, because witchcraft is a form of protest, and we'll get into that. Because I wanted to add a voice that I think would be more informed and more cohesive, rather than what you see in these ideas, these frightening ideas of better than thou, or if we go down like the neo-Nazi route, like these are things that exist in the diversity of the American cauldron. So it was just important for me, I think, to put something out there that I would want to put in my students' hands, or that I would feel comfortable putting my name on. And it's funny, because I had no idea how much book this would take off. And I'm very blessed that this book has been very successful. And I'm hoping this book has even more success, because I do think it has something very important to say.
Absolutely. And just to clarify, American, you're referring to the United States, not the whole continent, right?
Absolutely.
Because we are trying to learn that when we say America, we're talking about continent. When we say United States, it's the country. And yeah, the hodgepodge, the how do you call it, the cauldron, right? The melting pot. The melting pot pot in which black and brown people, indigenous people, haven't been able to make it in the pot yet. We're
But
still holding the fire. Right? We're
they
still
are the
holding
pot.
the fire.
They are literally the pot that holds those things.
I think we are the fire burning it, right?
And the fire and the thing, because everything that, like,
Yeah.
let's look at candle magic for a minute.
Yeah.
All that we know about candle magic comes from indigenous, Latino, brown people.
Yeah.
And of course, from the slave trade. I mean, there's so many things that I think, and it's funny because this has been a recent conversation I've been having with other people in my covens of like, we're really American. How does that make us distinct? Because there's something very distinct about the United States and my neighbors having these gods, my other neighbors having these gods, and how my spirits interact with that
Yeah.
and that sort of place.
What I meant, because where you're talking about things being political, I'm very political. What I meant by saying that we're not in the pot is we haven't reaped the privileges of the
Absolutely.
so-called melting pot in the United States. But you know, and you understand, we are the pot, we are the fire, we are the water inside. We are what keep it going. We just don't have the benefits and the privileges that white United States people
Absolutely.
have. That's what I meant. And speaking about politics, so witches are made, witches are born, witches are trained, and there is no such thing as the blood. However, comma, we do have traditions and we do have folklore, and you went, as you say, on a rabbit's hole with all the folklore. Some might say you dare touch a bunch of sacred cows. You touch a bunch of texts and folklore. How did you, let me say, get inspired, get the spark to actually go for it and dissect all these stories and folklore? We haven't, I'm going to talk about my favorite one in a minute, but I want to know your answer.
Yeah. Oh, because we're gearing up to what's also, I love that we have a mutual favorite sort of
Yes.
thing. It's a love. But I went to what I knew were the sources, the historical sources of where my practices and traditions came from. So I knew that there were certain texts, very outdated, very from the white male gaze, things like Fraser's The Golden Bough, things like Margaret Murray's Witch cult thesis, all of these things that we cannot dismiss as modern people because these things are the very foundations of our history. It doesn't mean that they're not true, and it doesn't mean that they're necessarily wrong, but what it means is that these are the ideas that created that whirlpool. And so it was important to me to invest time and to see where that came from, to where that came from. Because as witches, people who have ancestral practices, pagans, whatever we identify as, I think we're very tied up to this longing of who we are and where we come from. And I think that following sort of that bridge from ancient people to who we are now is an important piece to our practices, no matter who we are. And this was a way for me to do it off of the sources that I knew were important. Even though they may have only been hinted at by my teachers or elders, or even though that I knew I would have to spend many an hour in the Library of Congress. But I also really got into the heads of the people who were sort of saying these ideas. People like Joe Wilson in 1734, which took me to the works and the letters of Robert Cochrane. And of course, people like Gerald Gardner, who mentions this idea of blood in his book Witchcraft Today. So there was a consistency. And that's always a ding, 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 ding. And that's when I say the goddess rings her bell and tells you, pay attention, because it was a very that. And if you look at these stories and when you read the book, you'll see that these stories all echo each other. They are soft reflections, and it's who's to say what came first, the chicken or the egg. And that's why witchcraft will always be a mystery cult. We work with mysteries, and our DNA and how we do that magically, that's a mystery, and that mystery was worth exploring.
And I love that you mentioned DNA, to be brought up in a very positive vein, because I recently had an experience where people are talking about DNA for their own benefit, you know, to like separate people of other genders, and that's just the crack of you know what. But the truth of the matter is that the part of the DNA that is important and is real is whether your ancestors live in the realm of your imagination or your psychic or your spirit, your psyche or your spirit. There is an undeniable truth that your ancestors are on the makeup of your DNA. So I forgot the numbers because, again, I'm not good at reading and remembering. I'm not good at listening and remembering. That I think is five generations, and you already got like 8,000 people donating DNA towards your existence. So if that in and of itself is not magical, then what is, right? And who's to say that your ancestor or my ancestor did not really practice these things, maybe call them something different? Because the truth is, there's only one Earth, there's only one moon, there's only one sun, there's four seasons, and that happens globally. And a little bit of your experience as I'm listening to you, going into this rabbit hole of all these commonalities. Can you imagine coming from an indigenous background and then knowing that many of the peoples of what is now called Mexico have these practices that are very similar, right? And then coming to paganism here in the United States and seeing all these similarities, I'm like, yeah, I can be pagan too. And you know,
Absolutely.
I choose to be indigenous and pagan because I know where one ends and the other one begins. But it's like, and without appropriating things, people, please don't appropriate things. People,
Okay.
please learn from indigenous people. We're not mythical and ancient. We're right here.
I pop off on that in the book. I forget. It's a pop-off moment though. And I think at first we edited it down so it wasn't so snippy sounding. But it was very much like this idea too. And I'm so glad you brought this up of like, again, for me growing up in the United States, I come from, just one generation down Irish, family, and Northern Irish at that, which is very sort of different. Very different. So for me, I was interested in specifically in the 1980s, where there were a lot of books coming around that were like Celtic magic and Norse magic and this kind of, it was all this kind of stuff, right? Where it was the same, you cast a circle, you have your four tools, you wave your wand, but maybe the god names were different, or maybe there would be like Thor's hammer for the Nordic people, but maybe a triquetra for the Celtic people, right? But not much distinction. And that wasn't what that is. But then you would meet somebody who would have actually gone to Ireland and stayed with somebody and learned the cultural evolution, how the language affects things, how the land affects things, and those distinctions of the experience. And this is the key takeaway of everything I'm saying here. The experience of these things has to be an experience. You cannot have an experience from reading about it, writing about it, even interviewing about it. You have to experience it alongside your fellow man. And that's so much of what we do as witches. Witchcraft is entirely, I think, 100% experiential. You can't sit on this. You have to do it. And the magic and the mysteries and the gods are found in the doing, which is why there's always some sort of activity behind it, no matter what the activity is. You make it magical. Magic is up to you.
Yeah. And the thing of like you say, praxis and how many people we have learned about, not only the United States, my experiences that everywhere in the at least United States and Mexico. Where people shift from one religion that is very structured, and then they go to paganism, and they stay on. It's just like just changing the icon, right? They get rid of white Jesus, and then they put,
Some horns on it.
I don't know, Thor or whatever, and then now it's like praising and being devout and. But the practice is the same. There is no empowerment. And I think as you mentioned earlier, with witchcraft being a political tool, that the practice comes in the rebellion, and the rebellion is the practice. And now we're going to talk about my favorite part of the book, which you touch very lovingly, which is the Gospel of Aradia. Why are so many witchy people, practitioners, why so many people dislike the Gospel of Aradia? It's such a beautiful
Yeah.
tool, and it's.
I will say this. And I have there's the thing is because of and I do get into the history of how this text came into being. It's got a very mystical history, but that history is a spotty history. The things it's actually rooted in are even spottier at best. And by the time the internet came out, the world became obsessed with this idea of historical accuracy. And so I think it made us uncomfortable that something that was regarded as a gospel now is viewed and can be viewed and certainly viewed as an inspired piece, rooted in maybe some mystical things, but there's some fictional elements for sure woven throughout that. But the whole history of how it came into being makes it a skeptical text. And that in itself is, I think, part of why today people are uncomfortable with it, but also I think because it was so heavily quoted and so heavily used, specifically during the 80s and 70s and the West, sort of feminist movement, and it was kind of used in a way that was good for its time. But I think we've kind of evolved and seen more of the text then. It's there, but it's also not realized. But this text is rooted in a lot of different things, a lot of different things that modern practitioners do as neo-pagans or initiates or witches. They're doing things that are found and coming from directly out of the text. If I may, I would like to share with you. I wrote so the Gospel of Aradia is complicated. It's very complicated to get into the story. And so to get to sort of the birth of this goddess, I had to figure out a way creatively to synthesize those first chapters. And so what I did, being a poet, is I wrote a poem, and I'm hoping I can share that with you.
Yeah, so remind me which page it is so I can follow
I'm
along.
gonna be on sick page 65.
Because I have the book. You don't have the book, you need to go buy it, folks. Sorry. Sorry if you don't have the book, you need to go buy it.
So this is the creation myth of Aradia. So in the beginning, ooh, where have you heard that before? There was but the spirit of Diana in the vast abyss and a time out of mind. She was the one being before creation, for it has been said that within her were all things. From herself, she divided into the light and the darkness, giving birth to Lucifer as her consort. Other self and the light, becoming the moon, and he the sun. Diana, still of the night in the dark abyss, fell in love with this splendiferous being that came from her. She sought to consult the spirits before the first spirit, the mothers and fathers of the beginning. Those were the giant celestial elder gods. They told her that to capture the heart of Lucifer, she must go to earth incarnated as a human woman. In a totemic shape-shifting chase began Diana's hunt of the night for her union with the light. She was the cat and he the mouse. The hunt of the cat and mouse occurred as the wheel of seasons turned and turned. In a solar eclipse of the cosmic light, Diana's pursuit took winged flight. Those two became one and then became three to make children of the earth beloved and free. To then after soothe the anger-fallen sun, the mother's cord in motion had already begun. Splendor had coupled with the shadow of his twin to vanquish the curse of the false god sin. And Diana, unto ever-loving Lucifer's plight, sang unto him the song of night, and on her wheel spun moonlight, from Aradia, savior, birthed in sight. So Diana's wheel of fate seal turns as Lucifer's fire of Gnosis burns, making her spindle go round and round, affecting the fates of mortal ground. For Aradia taught them the mysteries of all that be, to dance, sing under the moon, naked and free. She awakened the blood, the power within, round temple and groves of the people therein. For incarnated the voice of Diana spoke, the power of fairy together with folk.
Can you tell me people have interviewed you and never tap into that part of the book?
This is
Why?
the first time we've really gotten to chit chat about Aradia, and it's my favorite. It really is.
I love the poem, and I love your art, and I love how you wrote all that. And I love that seems that we love the same things, right? Like the knowledge that Aradia came to teach those who were enslaved, those who
The
were
oppressed, the
other.
yes,
Yeah.
and
And
Diana,
go ahead.
and Diana, and I get more into the history, but Diana is super important because, unlike these other sort of gods that are synthesizing in Rome and going into Magna Graecia, or we're going into Italy, Diana remains what is referred to as the indigenous goddess. So she has to be the first goddess that people make their offerings to, that people go to. And she's the most accessible goddess because she's the goddess of the wild. She's the goddess of the land versus Hera. Hera is of the priesthood, and you have to have money, you have to have offerings, you have to have a subscription so you can enter those temple gates, which you may not ever, ever, ever see that statue. That's for a very specific priesthood. So good luck with Hera. But Diana, you get a mask, you put it on the boughs of a cedar tree, you dance. So Diana's for all the people. Diana is a goddess of the folk, and that's why she lasts throughout all of history. It's why she's mentioned in the Book of Acts in the Bible and is associated with pagans, because people will always hang on to the indigenous, the first goddess, which of course is Diana.
And it's beautiful. I'm still recovering from the poem, but I love to see, and thank you for rescuing Diana. I recently have a very bad experience, so I'm still healing
Yeah.
that.
And
But we have to remind people that Diana is for the oppressed. And it has been hijacked by the oppressors, right? And oppressors come in all forms. It could be male and female or otherwise. And it's good to see and to refresh. For me, it was like a balsamic refresher to remember the book and to say, Diana is this, and know what the oppressing tradition of the West is trying to
Of
make.
yeah, of the West. I mean, and the thing is too, is even when things happen, and this is actually from a really great pagan scholar, but when religious groups become too structured, they start to fracture. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, because when they do that, we very well run the risk to become the things we ran from in the first place. We see that overwhelmingly in Hollywood. I mean, look, Hollywood right now, so there's nothing new under the sun.
No.
People, to quote To Kill a Mockingbird, people are people. People are people, Atticus. And it's such an important thing, because Diana is so important, because she will meet you where you're at if you truly come with a humble heart, an open mind, and a fierce will. Those are the three things that, in my relationship with her, she demands of her people, and there's no bullshitting her, or
Yeah.
else she just won't show up.
Yeah. And I think we have to remember that, like hoodoo, like voodoo, like Santeria, like even now the worship of Santa Marte and all this resources of folk that has been oppressed over the centuries, they're not toys, you know. Some people are coming at them as if they were toys, like, oh, it's cool. Like Santa Muerte looks like a rock star, so let me worship. And this is like Nancy who lives in New York on a $3,000 apartment. And
Right.
like, Nancy, where are you trying to liberate yourself from? Right?
Right.
And I'm not saying Nancy don't need liberation, but she can tap into perhaps different icons that are not politically revolutionary, created for the oppressed, It's just
Yeah, it's a good observation, and I think it's interesting because, for instance, like, okay, she's on my I have Hecate on her, and Hecate in today's day and age is probably more popular now than she's ever was when she had her original mystery cult. She is big, and so it makes me question, like, I wonder why certain deities have certain levels of prominence. And it changes. It ebbs and it flows. I think these things speak to us in ways that are what I call of the oneric, of the dreaming realm, the things that really speak to us. And when there is something of lack, people will take that where they can find it. And ignorance is one of the biggest things that propels that. But also, I think what propels that is what is marketed to people. So for Santa Morte, right? When Home Depot uses a almost exact version of that statuary for their decor, and the observation is made, for all of a sudden now people are going to be interested in this. It's also, I saw a meme where it's like, oh no, all the people wanting to be witches because of Agatha, what do we do? But it does make you think of, there's something that they have a moment in time, they make an appearance, and there's a call, and that call will bring in the good, the bad, the ugly, but the good I think will stick around.
Yeah, and is what Heather Green said in her book, right? This resurgence of the witch every so often when we are having a lot of oppression. And what I was saying on my tongue-in-cheek example is like, yeah, we know Nancy has oppression, but maybe she could look on her own background, on her own culture,
Absolutely.
because what you open the book with is know thyself
And know where you came from.
and know where you came from.
Because that, if you know yourself, that'll take you to your ancestors, and then your ancestors will take you to places that you haven't even dreamed of. And those dark and secret, twisted places of the liminal, there
Yeah.
you find she who is the goddess.
Yeah. And knowing ourselves truly, I was just talking last month with forget her name, Alice Markham Cantor, who wrote The Once and Future Witch Hunt, into how many people of the world, and by that I liberate Nancy, you don't exist, you're free. I was just using your name as an example. How many witches go around and say, specifically United States witches, saying, I'm the granddaughter of the witches you couldn't burn? Like, those women were Christians. They were God-fearing Christians. Like, you probably wouldn't be a descendant. And Miss Alice Markham Cantor is actually a descendant of one of the people. And they, she does not identify as a witch. And so it is this game in which we romanticize all these things that may not be beneficial. Can you imagine the ancestors of this imaginary Nancy when she calls on Santa Muerte and the ancestors appear and they're like, what are you doing, child?
My pearls,
My
just pearls.
That's
Trying
it.
to find where I write it, because it is very, I did sort of brush on this, and it's such an important point to be made, because ancestors are sort of core, I think, to earth-based practices, magical practices. To me, they certainly are. And I think if you enter a magical path or a pagan path, your ancestors will be knocking on the door very, very soon. They are intrinsic to that path. Let's see
Absolutely.
here. Do, 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 do.
Well, I hope you find it. And while you look, and let me while you look, and Nathan, I'm going to mute you for a second. And I'm going to tell folks we are nearing the end in our show. And I want to remind everybody to listen to all of the offerings that we have on CSNP, the Circle Sanctuary Network podcast. We have podcasts, Circle Talk with Deborah Rose. We have Circle of Nature with Selena Fox. We have Songs of the Pagan Tribe with Karen Greenman. We have Blue Marble with Charlotte Bear. We have Paganos del Mundo in Spanish and Portuguese on Saturdays with Christian Ortiz, Carolina Moore, Monica Govin. and Patricia Finclair, and yours truly, Laura Gonzalez. And we have, of course, Lunatic Mondays with Laura Gonzalez as well. We have over 1,100 podcasts, roughly an hour each, from which you can listen, download, share, keep for your personal archives. And please go and support us. Tell your friends, tell your friends to tell your friends to listen to CSMP. And when it comes to Laura Gonzalez, if you want to have Laura Gonzalez continue bringing you podcasts and entertainment, please support me on my endeavors. You can go to bluewitch.org, bluewitch.org, where I have offerings and classes and stuff that you can help support me so I can carve the time during my days to come and interview these wonderful authors. And now I'm going to ask you to unmute Nathan so you can tell us if you found it.
I found it.
Yay!
Oh. This is on page 22, which is in when I get into the whole hereditary witchcraft argument. And I write, during my time living publicly as a witch in Salem, Massachusetts, it was especially concerning when people would approach me to declare their title of hereditary witch without understanding the implications. Many make claims and falsify their ancestry to the Salem witch trials as if being related to any of the puritanical people murdered means they are of a superior heritage of witches. This idea is disturbing as it denotes a lack of understanding of puritanical history, the long, complex history of witchcraft, and how its definition is constantly changing. To this day, many have a preconceived notion that witchcraft can be defined as one thing or as a uniform set of practices throughout history. They may share traits and commonalities, but witchcraft practices are varied, independent, and vastly different through a variety of cultural lenses. So there's my sticking point in some of the things, yeah.
And definitely, if you want to learn more about the witch trials and all that, like I said, September 9th, we interview Alice Markham Counter, the Once and Future Witch Hunt. And it's a beautiful historical compilation, historical and fictional. And she goes, weaves in and out into her family because she is a descendant. And it's just beautiful. And just as beautiful as this book. I'm so thankful, Nathan, for you to being on the show. To the boys, I call them the boys, they're my friends.
They're the boys, right? No, they're the Malloway bros. They're the
The
boys.
Malloway brothers, Blake and Wick, for giving me this book. And before I say goodbye, thank you for taking the chance and thank you for scratching the itch that probably a lot of us had, and none of us had the spark to go scratch, And before we go, is there anything I haven't asked you that you want to share about this book?
No, but I would like to share maybe another poem.
Yes, please.
I just, poetry is sort of my thing. It's how the gods speak to me. It really is. And it's how when I'm able to get into really consistent rhyme, almost like a rap, I feel this cloak of presence. And I think, some people can see sort of that change. So let's see what we get here. But one of the more powerful rituals, and you referenced it, was this idea that, we all come from one thing. We come from one mother. Science may call her mitochondrial Eve, but I call her the first witch. I think the first mother of humanity was truly accessing magic. And so I give a rite in the book to venerate whoever we may associate this mythopoetic rite as the first witch. You get to do all this fun aspecting embodiment work with her, but then, as her, you will give this charge, and of course, there it is. All right, so here we are. Behold these shades and spirits of earth. For this time alone, I return as I have returned time before, feared and revered, long gone but never dead. I am the witch in your head, old as time and forever alive. I am the queen bee of all hives. From root to flower and sky to rain, I give what you seek in the fire's name, in the name of power which none may know, by birch, ash, thorn, and willow. I reside in the oaks with boughs touching down, over my head a starry crown, covering of sacrifice, for the first I became, as you too shall be in these names, Inanna, Ishitar, Lilitu, these your greatest of grandmothers of mothers, to the womb and tomb, the mystery am I, the mystery are you, this is my charge.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you very much, Nathan. And of course, you can find this book wherever you get your books. We always recommend that you go to your local witchy, esoteric mom and pop shops. But in case they don't have them, you can tell the owners to call the Cross Crow Boys, the Malleway Brothers, or where else can we get your book?
My book's available through Red Wheel Wiser. My book is also available on Amazon. It's through Barnes and Noble, pretty much all the hot spots. And then, if anybody is so kind, I would love to see some Amazon reviews. It really does help the book, and it helps out the publishers. It helps me. Amazon reviews are super, super helpful. If anybody would be so inclined, it would be much appreciated from yours truly.
And you know, folks, you don't have to buy the book through Amazon. You can just go and review it and say that you have it, that you bought it, and that you want to review it. And I always remind people of this. It's funny. You don't have to read the whole book and you don't have to write an essay. You can just say, I like the book, and that's it. And Amazon and Goodreads. Amazon and Goodreads.
Amazon and Goodreads, yes. And the art, and there's art in here that's also worth, I think, some really good artwork in here worthwhile. So do get yourself a copy.
Yeah. And it's a great read. I mean, duh. I don't interview people I don't like the book about. So The Awakening, The Witch Blood, don't let yourself be fooled by the title, like I did. And come and join us and come and find your power, because it's in there, it's within you.
It's there, it's in all of you, and it's there even more when we're all together. So,
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you so much for listening, folks. Thank you so much for watching, you who are watching here on YouTube. Until we meet again, never forget that you are loved. Thank you, Nathan, for being on the show. And I'll leave you the microphone so you can say goodnight to your audience.
good night, everybody, and all the blessings, and take care.
Good night, folks. And you know, I said it before, now I'm going to say it again. You are loved. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us on the Circle Sanctuary Network podcast, presented by Circle Sanctuary and produced for all who follow nature-centered paths. Join us throughout the week for various programming connecting with the community around the world. Please don't forget to watch for updates on the Circle Sanctuary website at www.circlesanctuary.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/CSN podcasts. We can also be found on your favorite podcast hosting sites such as iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and others. Until next time, many blessings.